Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. B-F-T. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
We all saw the NBA in the bubble last season. We watched it. You watched it down the stretch. You watched it... You watch the NBA teams jockey for position while they were also trying to stay healthy. But we didn't think much about what it was like to be in the bubble. Ben Golliver of the Washington Post has written a good book. And Ben Golliver is a friend of this show. Used to cover the Blazers on a daily basis. But he wrote a book called Bubble Ball. And I am fascinated by this book. I know, Peter Sampson, you just got your copy, didn't you?
Yeah, just came in the mail yesterday. I'm only about 10 pages in, but I remember hearing that he was writing it, and it's such a unique experience. He was one only two or three, maybe four guys down there. I'm stoked to read it.
Strangest NBA season ever. Ben Golliver was there to capture it. He joins us now. Ben Golliver, where are you today?
At home in Los Angeles, laying low. Fully vaccinated, feeling good about life. How's everything going for you?
Going well, man. Going well. We started today's show by saying that. You know, I've got a little bit of throat issue here, but I'm powering through it. And I got to ask you, like, I love that you wrote this book. What made you want to write it?
Well, I thought 2020 was basically going to go down as one of the most important years in NBA history. When you look back at, you know, the China controversy with Hong Kong, Kobe Bryant's death, David Stern's death, the pandemic shutting the season down. And then on top of all of that, this crazy comeback plan where they're just trying to salvage billions of dollars to make sure the sport can go forward and crown a champion. And they're going to do it at Disney World. I mean, it just kind of fell in my lap, didn't it? And, you know, to me, I just wanted to be, you know, kind of the guy who created a time capsule for what's one of the craziest years in NBA history. And, you know, I was down at Disney World for 93 days, 92 nights. And for like the first 2 weeks, John, I was doing interviews with people all over the world. And basically, they just wanted to know if I was going to die. You know, that's really what it boiled down to. They're like, what are you doing in the bubble? Is this going to work? Is one player going to get sick and everybody gets sick? I mean, there was so much curiosity around it. And by the end of it, you know, there wasn't a single positive test. They crowned the champion. It was a very memorable playoff run with a lot of high-quality basketball. And yet it happened all in empty gyms with, you know, mask protocols and, you know, daily testing and everything else. So I just thought, you know, look, this is going to be the most interesting year of basketball I ever cover. I better write a book. And thankfully, I was able to do that.
22 teams in the bubble at Disney World. What was it like as a media member to walk through the doors there and be part of that?
Well, I felt like Rihanna or Jack Nicklaus, man, Jack Nicholson. I've never felt cooler having courtside seats, being able to hear all the trash talk on the court. And then at the same time, like, I had no personal freedom. You know, it was a quirky experience, but it was also a really challenging experience because, you know, I couldn't drive anywhere. When we first got there, our little media pen was 0.8 miles in diameter. So, you know, you could walk the entire thing in about 12 or 13 minutes. All the food was prepackaged. I mean, it was a very rigorous lifestyle, you know, and so for me, it was like there was a real adjustment period. And, John, you know, I'm not afraid to say this. I know a lot of the players have talked about how challenging it was for them. You know, LeBron, Paul George talked about the mental health battles. I mean, I put on weight. I didn't sleep well. I was anxious. My stress level was up. I had crazy feelings of isolation from the outside world. I mean, it was really tough, but at the same time, it was a basketball junkie's heaven because I went to every single playoff game from the second round on. So I was like living my dream in kind of nightmare circumstances all at once. It was great.
Ben Golliver with us, Washington Post NBA writer. The book is called Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. They came very close to leaving the bubble. How real was that?
Oh, it was real for sure. I mean, you could sense it in the days leading up to the actual boycott that guys were not happy with that Jacob Blake shooting. I mean, really upset, furious with that shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And it had been bubbling all summer long. I think the presidential election hanging over everything and there's just kind of back and forth going on was also, you know, kind of on people's minds as well. And it was a spontaneous situation. You know, I remember vividly that game where the Bucks didn't take the court, John, because I've been covering the NBA since 2007. And just like every game, you go and you set your computer up, you make sure you're plugged in, you got your headphones, you got your iced tea, you got your water. You look up and there's only one team on the court. You're saying, wait a minute, something's different here. Something's not right. And I was kind of cruising through the arena trying to peek in the locker room doors. You know, I looked in the Orlando Magic locker room. Their star, Nikola Vucevic, is kind of looking back out towards me with the same look that I've got on my face. He's like, what's happening? Are we even playing today? What's going on? And, you know, you just kind of go through that process minute by minute of that shutdown, and you could tell it was very tense. At the same time, I had faith that they were going to put it back together because the financial future of the sport was on the line. You know, I mean, the NBA has lost so much money from the pandemic by not having fans in buildings, and it's altered their TV contracts and their schedules and their television ratings and everything else, that if the whole thing were to blow up and they didn't actually crown a champion and get the finals and all that stuff, it would have been absolutely massive. They probably would have had to scrap the collective bargaining agreement and start over. So to me, I always kind of had faith that money would win out. And in a way, the players, once they got down there, they were kind of trapped. They needed to fulfill their end of the obligations. But there were some tense conversations over the next couple of days. And ultimately, it was a three-day shutdown. One funny note during that three-day shutdown, though, John, I mean, guys were getting restless because they had so many games to play. Basically, they played every other day for months in a row, right? And this was the first stoppage where they could really catch their breath. And I remember seeing Kawhi Leonard in a golf cart like he was a 75-year-old grandfather just doing donuts and driving in circles around this one parking lot because he's like, what else am I supposed to do? You know, he can't get in a real car. He can't go anywhere. There's no real fun to be had. And so that's how they were kind of passing their time during the shutdown. I'll never forget that.
It's fascinating to see this. I think what makes great books, Ben, is access, you know, and what you had was unique. How many other media members were in the bubble?
So there was about 10 independent writers, in other words, people who weren't affiliated with, you know, the official broadcasters, so ESPN or TNT or NBA TV. But some of those others, they would swap out, right? And so I was actually lucky enough to be there the whole time, like I said, 93 days. And so, you know, I started with the very beginning as all the players are first getting accustomed to the new rules. And one of the first people I see coming out, I described this in chapter one, is Donovan Mitchell, who's like, welcome to the bubble. He was like the unofficial bubble ambassador, NBA All-Star for the Utah Jazz, because he just happened to be in the right place at the right time when the media got let out of our quarantines, right? And then I traced it all the way through to the very end, which is, you know, LeBron James on the last night of the bubble just dousing me and some other media members with champagne head to toe, you know, pretty much soaking my suit, making my glasses fog up, because he just didn't have anybody cooler to celebrate with, John. There was nobody else down there. There's no fans. You know, they strictly limited how much of your family could be in attendance. He was separated from his children for months. And so, you know, he had to settle for spraying a bunch of media members. And certainly that made for a memorable post-game celebration. So I tried to trace the whole thing from start to finish. And, you know, I do want to point out, like, the health protocols were strict. You know, it wasn't like we could just go hang out in a player's room. I mean, they really made a bubble within the bubble to protect the players for their own safety. But I did think it was extraordinary access at these games before, during, and after, you know, watching players warm up. You know, I remember seeing Damian Lillard just seething at the trash talk from the Clippers, you know, Patrick Beverley and Paul George when he missed those free throws. You know, being in that room, I mean, you could cut the tension with a knife. And then as soon as he walked out towards the bus, you know, some media members were like, watch out, man. This next week is going to be trouble for everybody Portland plays. And sure enough, he went on an absolutely crazy tear to get the Blazers into the playoffs.
The book is called Bubble Ball. Ben Golliver is the author. He's with us, Washington Post NBA writer. If you had to go back, Ben, you're going back for another 93 days. What would you bring with you that would make it more tolerable?
I would say food. I mean, that was the main thing. You know, I talk about some of the options they sent us. You know, I'm a vegetarian, and they had a veggie meatloaf, John. I just want you to picture a brick that's brown with brown sauce being delivered in a styrofoam container to you. And I mean, you just take one look at it and it's like, it's not only that you're not hungry for that meal, You're not hungry for the rest of the day, and you're probably not hungry for like 72 hours after you look at it. So I think I would have done that. You know, a couple of people were able to finagle like treadmills or Pelotons, like just kind of, you know, exercise devices for themselves. I personally didn't feel comfortable going to the small gym that was on campus, just because of, you know, just COVID paranoia, if you want to call it that. So I did a lot of walking around outside, and you know, I got a lot of miles in that really uncomfortable 95 degree, you know, sticky, yeah, swampy Orlando feeling. Guys like Eric Spoelstra wearing T-shirts that say heat culture as he's just, you know, cranking out his miles in the afternoon sun. So, you know, I have some fond memories of that. But I think I probably would have tried to ramp up the quality of my diet so I could have eaten a little bit better, and then maybe try to explore some alternative exercise activities. It was funny. I was pacing back and forth during my hotel room, and I posted a video of that, and everybody was kind of mocking me because I looked like, you know, almost you know, a rabbit, you know, walking around, yeah, in a laboratory, you know, spinning wheel or whatever. And so I had a bunch of people, you know, send me like free, you know, courses. Hey, do you want to sign up for our new course? We've got this indoor exercise program, you know, we'd be glad to help sponsor you or whatever. And of course I had to say no to all that, but, you know, it was a real challenge for us when you're stuck inside for 7 days. And I know all your listeners have been dealing with that too here during the pandemic. Like, what's the best way to stay fit while also staying safe?
It's really interesting because you know, I was skeptical that they could do this. I was skeptical that it would be pulled off successfully. And in the end, I had to say, like, I thought the basketball was pretty good. I thought that they kept everybody safe, and it became kind of a diversion for a lot of us that were missing sports because the NBA led the way. It led the sort of departure from sports. You know, when they walked off the court and, hey, there's a pandemic going on, and everybody else followed, and then they have led it back. Who do you give credit to? Is that Adam Silver?
I think it's everybody. I mean, I know you like me. I mean, you know, we're opinionated. We're stubborn guys. We love to be right. In this case, I was, you know, happy to be proven wrong. I mean, the whole time I thought 22 teams, it's too many teams. You don't need to bring all these teams. Just bring 8. Just bring 16. Crown a champion. Get it done in a month and a half. Don't make it 3 months long. Keep it easy. You know, don't let anybody get sick. I mean, that'd be the worst possible thing if a player got sick and died. I mean, imagine the tragedy and the backlash if that happened. So I had a lot of those concerns going into it, but you got to tip your hat to the NBA. Their health protocol, it was insanely rigorous, John. I mean, they had me wearing a tag where if I got too close to anybody else, it would start beeping like a smoke detector to ensure that I maintained appropriate social distance. Wow. When I was walking around on campus one night, security guards pulled up on me and demanded to see my ID, my credentials, to make sure that I was, you know, supposed to be in the bubble and not some sort of a trespasser. We know that they kicked out Daniel House from the Houston Rockets for violating the protocols. A number of other players, like Lou Williams with the strip club incident, got thrown back into quarantine. So they took the rules very seriously. But I want to give a lot of credit to the players. Look, they sacrificed a lot more comforts than I did, right? I mean, they're used to, in a lot of cases, mansions or at least very fancy condos, nice cars, sometimes private chefs. I mean, they're living a good life. You know, for me, it wasn't that big of an adjustment going from a one-bedroom apartment in L.A. to a hotel room, you know, in Disney World. It's kind of like a Courtyard by Marriott, same thing I'm staying at when I cover the playoffs normally, right? I mean, these guys really had to adjust their whole lifestyles and live at a different quality standard than they're used to as millionaires. And I think their buy-in ultimately is what made this thing successful all the way through to the finish. But there was very clear leadership focus from Adam Silver. You probably remember with about a week or two to go in the bubble, there had been no positive tests. And I think he told CNN, my favorite emoji is the finger crossed, right? He still didn't want to let up. He wanted to have that perfect health record because he thought that would be the legacy of the bubble. And I think he's absolutely right. And you compare it to this season with so dozens of positive tests, a whole bunch of postponed games in January. This season's been pretty messy. A lot of guys in and out of the lineup. And I think the bubble should go down as a smash success. As weird and as quirky and as challenging as it was, the NBA and the players nailed it.
Ben Golliver's new book is called Bubble Ball. It's about the NBA's fight to save last basketball season. Ben, you did a great job with this book. And you know, ultimately, the Lakers walk off with the ring. Do you think the bubble changed the outcome of anything? Like, would home courts have mattered to any of these teams, or did we get a result that we probably would have got anyway?
Well, I think that they looked like the best team pretty much the entire time down there, and both LeBron and Anthony Davis really raised their games. I thought they were the two best players in the bubble from start to finish, so I think that they were very worthy champions. And I do think the best validation for the bubble experience, and the reason why I don't think anyone should try to apply an asterisk here, is you look at the number of teams who came out of the bubble and made major changes based on what happened in the bubble, right? Hmm. New Orleans fires their coach. Philadelphia fires their coach, hires a new GM, makes a couple of big trades. Milwaukee goes out and makes a big trade to grab a Jrue Holiday. And the list goes on. Houston completely blows up its entire coach, roster, stars, all of it, right? And so I think that, you know, if the bubble had been viewed as a lark, you know, or just, oh, that was just a summer AAU tournament, who cares, you know, Mickey Mouse title, not really that big of a deal, I don't think you would have seen the teams respond to the games that were played there as dramatically as they did. And I think that's one of the big takeaways here, too. The teams acted like it counted, so in my view, it should count. And, you know, would crowds have made a difference? It's possible, but the Lakers would have had home court advantage basically the whole way, because they were the number one seed and they were the higher seed in all of their series. So that should have only played more to their benefit. So to me, I think that we have to validate that title. And certainly I came away from the experience thinking that the right team won. Now, there was plenty of unexpected upsets along the way. And I like to get into, you know, did the bubble impact why Milwaukee fell out, right? Or why Boston lost in the Eastern Conference Finals, or why Philly was swept early. And there's certainly aspects of that experience that you can point to and say, it changed the direction for certain teams, but I do think ultimately the right team won.
Ben Golliver with us, Washington Post NBA writer. Off the top of the show, we were talking about the Blazers. You've got the view from 20,000 feet on the Blazers, the roster. They feel stuck in the middle again, Ben. What do you see?
Well, I think they're the team everybody wants to play right now, and that could be a double-edged sword, right? I mean, that could be, you could be upset about that. You can kind of get down on yourself and think, oh, you know, we're just chopped liver compared to some of the favorites in the Western Conference. Or you could say, well, great, we have no expectations, let's go in there and be spoilers. But you look at the defense, it's just not good enough to enter into that top tier that you're describing. If you're going to be awesome on offense and bad on defense, you're going to be right there in the middle, like you're saying. I think I look at some of their moves this year, it just seemed like they were trying to tread water. It didn't seem like there was a big splashy move forward. You look at that Norman Powell trade. To me, that's a short-term fix. You know, I'll be surprised or impressed if they're actually able to retain him and pay to keep him, given how much money they've invested at their other guard spots. And so I do think, you know, to a degree, it's almost like they're just trying to put their head down and get through this pandemic and come back the other side of it. And I can understand why that would be frustrating for fans who say, hey, we've seen this story before. You're good enough to make the playoffs, but not good enough to make a deep run. And I think that's kind of where they are. But, you know, if I'm Utah, if I'm Phoenix, if I'm the Clippers, you know, any of those top three seeds in the West right now, I would rather play Portland than Dallas with Luka, or Golden State with Steph Curry, if he can kind of sneak them in through the play-in round. And I think Portland's going to have to be really careful here, because if they slide back into the seven, now they're dealing with that play-in tournament. You know, now it's potentially, you know, they're one game or two games to decide whether they're going to make the playoffs. And, you know, those coin flips can kind of go either way. And for Portland, they've had great luck, and Damian Lillard has made great luck for them in close games this year, but it does seem like it's catching up with them a little bit here lately, and I would just be nervous. You know, I think that it's absolutely in their best interest to try to chase that sixth seed as much as they can, and we'll see if they're able to secure it.
Ben Golliver, Washington Post with us. It feels to me like, you know, they're a little stale. Terry Stotts likes to talk about defense, but I don't know if he has good defensive players. Meanwhile, you know, the passing of Paul Allen lingering, not sure if there's any impatience coming from ownership. Is it possible Terry Stotts doesn't survive at the end of this year? How do you view that?
Well, I don't necessarily think that he's the problem, and I think you've hit on the appropriate point, which is, what is the organizational goal? Is this the moment where you want to go in? Because the price right now in the NBA to go all in is sky high. Look what the Clippers had to pay to get Paul George. You know, it's like 5 years worth of draft picks and their best young player, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Look what the Milwaukee Bucks had to pay to get Jrue Holiday. Not only did they have to trade multiple players and a whole bunch of first-round picks, they also had to give him a $160 million extension for a guy who hasn't made an All-Star game in basically 10 years, right? So if you really want to be, or look what Brooklyn did to get James Harden, you know, trading a whole bunch of young players and a boatload of draft picks. So, you know, if you're trying to keep up with the Joneses right now, the price to do that is really, really high. And I have seen no indication from Portland's ownership or front office that they feel like they're in that mode. You know, it seems much more like, hey, let's just stay patient. Let's just try to roll this thing over. Let's just try to be, you know, maintain respectability, you know, put Damian in a situation where he has a chance to compete and win a series, but not go for broke. And I think, if, unfortunately, in the NBA right now, if you're not going for broke, you're going to get left behind. I mean, that's just the stakes. And same deal with the Lakers in terms of how much they gave up to get Anthony Davis a couple of summers ago. It's just a very expensive auction. You know, it's like you're at the auction, John, and people are paying, like, you know, $100,000 for a Ford, and you're sitting back saying, well, you know, do I really want to beat that bid, or, you know, should I just go home with a different car? And I think that's sort of the situation Portland finds itself in right now.
I kind of wonder about the patience from Damian Lillard. He's talked about wanting to stay in Portland, beat not a guy who's going to jump around, but I just wonder if they're in the same position 2 or 3 years from now, if his tune changes a little bit. How do you see sort of his legacy in that last stretch of his career?
Well, it's fascinating because you have this very clear divide. You have the superstars who are not willing to be patient whatsoever, and they need everything catered to them. So that's LeBron, Kevin Durant, now James Harden, Anthony Davis, the list goes on, right? You've got these other superstars more in the Tim Duncan or Dirk Nowitzki mold where it's, you know, I would say Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, Giannis, where they're saying, look, as long as you take care of me financially, give me that max contract and give me a chance, I'm going to be satisfied. I'm going to be okay with it, at least for now. And in the case of Steph Curry, I mean, he's been fighting through some tough losing seasons there recently, and he's still going and has made no moves about wanting to get out. I view Lillard more in that mold. I mean, the Blazers and the fan base have given him an awful lot, and I tend to trust his word when it comes to this stuff. I think he's a pretty open book in terms of how he's feeling, but you know, it is tricky. Like, you know, it's a real choice all these guys face. Kevin Durant faced the exact same decision in 2016. He could stick in Oklahoma City and be a legend there forever, or he could find a team that's going to give him a better chance to win a title. And he ultimately had to move, and then he moved again for the same reason, to kind of position himself in Brooklyn to win championships. And I think, you know, it's a choice all these guys have to make. But ultimately, I think, you know, Lillard, I trust his word on this one. I just really do.
Kevin Durant, you hit on it. He has been all over social media, embarrassing himself in some cases. What do you make of being thin-skinned, rabbit ears, whatever's going on with Kevin Durant?
It's so strange because on-court KD is like one of the most ruthless assassins, just draining three-pointers in LeBron's face, not afraid of the moment, always kind of been a clutch guy, always been super consistent, just the, you know, pinnacle of reliability and scoring. And everything you could ask for in a franchise player. And it's almost like this alter ego when he gets on Twitter, where he's just like seeking out whatever trash talk he can find. You know, frankly, I was happy that he apologized for the most recent incident because, you know, that was, even if the guy shouldn't have leaked those messages that he put out there, I mean, you know, you shouldn't be doing that under any circumstances. I think as a major ambassador for the sport, it's just kind of unforgivable. But I would love to get back into a situation where he's healthy enough that we just judge him based on his play, because he's arguably the best player in the world when he's healthy. And I think the Nets would be the favorites to win the title right now if all three of their stars can stay on the court. But unfortunately, that just hasn't been the case this year. I do think Kevin Durant's off-court persona does cast the Nets, or at least contributes to it, as them being the biggest villains this year in the postseason. I think everyone's going to be rooting against them. If they were to go out in the first round or the second round, I think Twitter would be just having a, you know, a party, a parade every single day, just day after day about it. I mean, especially given how Harden left Houston and just the, you know, the skepticism towards Kyrie Irving and his public personality. Plus, you've got Steve Nash, a rookie coach, and people always love to bag on the rookie coaches. I mean, they're just ripe for nitpicking, John. I could see that playing out that way.
Ben Golliver, his book is called Bubble Ball. Pick it up, order it on Amazon, find it in a bookstore. Ben Golliver, I appreciate you, my friend.
Oh, I appreciate you for letting me talk about it. And one final plug here, Powell's, don't forget. You can grab it there, too, for all the locals in Portland who want to support them. I'm sure that you could find it there in May 4th.
All right, stay safe, Ben Golliver. He's out of the bubble.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.